Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
We are now a little over 1 year away from the November 2012 presidential elections in the United States. And while that may seem like a long time, it is often just a blink of an eye in campaign terms. In fact, one could even say that the campaign season is well underway for the Republicans, who are tasked with the responsibility of picking a challenger to the incumbent President Barack Obama. And as many of us political scientists know, the presidential primary season is when a number of potential candidates are vetted, not only by their own partisans, but by those watching from the other side of the political fence. Although one would think that the majority of attention today would be on the economic platforms of the various candidates, this is America, after all, and what would a presidential campaign be if religion wasn't interjected into the debate? All of the three major frontrunners in the GOP primaries, as of mid-September 2011 when we are recording this, have had their spiritual faith come under scrutiny in one way or another. Mitt Romney, of course, has had to deal with the ubiquitous Mormon question since at least 2007 when he began his first presidential run in earnest. The question there is whether Mormonism is considered out of the mainstream of American Christianity, and whether he is independent enough from the leaders of the Latter-day Saints to be an effective leader for all Americans, an issue that likewise plagued John F. Kennedy as a Catholic early on in his presidential run. As for the other two current frontrunners at the moment, namely Michelle Bachmann and Rick Perry, they have been accused of being members of, or at least heavily influenced by, a theological movement known as Dominionism. Sometimes known as Christian Reconstructionism, adherents to this line of reasoning supposedly seek to impose a Christian theocracy on America, ruling over its citizens based on the legal principles found primarily in the Old Testament. What is this Dominionism, and how serious of a threat is it to secular governance? To answer these questions, I'm pleased to be joined today by Douglas Baker. Doug holds degrees from Louisiana State University, the New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary, and Johns Hopkins University, where he wrote an award-winning thesis entitled Toward an Evangelical Public Theology. He has served in numerous positions in both the private and public sector, including a stint as special assistant to Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee. He was the editor of the Baptist Messenger and currently is the assistant to the provost of Union University in Jackson, Tennessee. He also writes a regular column entitled Crisis and Kairos on Pathos.com. We'll link to that site so you can peruse his writings at your leisure. And don't forget, we also have a comment box that is up and working, so if you have any comments or thoughts about this show, please be civil and please post them. Doug, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, I'm honored to be here. Thank you for having me.
Okay, I'm a bit curious about the title of your blog at Pathos.com. What does crisis and kairos mean? You know, specifically, not being Greek or all that in tune with Greek philosophy, I'm not really sure what kairos means and why it might be linked to crisis.
Right. Well, the idea of crisis theology or of a crisis is nothing new to men, but it actually came out of my reading. While in seminary years ago, if I was reading Karl Barth, as you know, Barth lived during a very, very tumultuous time in world history, and much of his thought revolved around ideas of how Christian theology in particular would be able to address such horrid scenes as were upon the world in the 19-teens and 1920s.
You're talking about Karl Barth here, the theologian.
Yes, Karl Barth, yes. Okay. And his commentary on the Epistle to the Romans and around 1919 when he wrote that was a powerful influence on me when he talked about crisis theology. And how the kairos of the moment, or the Greek word there, is there's two in the New Testament used, chronos, chronological time, and kairos, which is a meaningful expression of time used by the Apostle Paul, like the fullness of time when Christ came forward, and the idea that there's theological significance and meritorious understanding in all of the crisis of life with the meaningful time of Kairos. So that basically came out of an idea of reading Barthes many years ago.
Okay, let's go on. Let's move on to dominionism right now, which is our focus today. And this accusation of dominionism was recently leveled against Michelle Bachmann and Rick Perry, seemingly out of the blue. Now, it is well known that both candidates are publicly Christian, with Perry having recently participated in a large Christian day of prayer for the nation. But the accusation of dominionism just all of a sudden appeared and got a lot of us scratching our heads wondering, what was this all about? Where did this most recent critique of dominionism originate?
As best as I can tell, it is a somewhat, as I said in the column, a neologism. It is a new word that has encountered the public square in a way that has not been done, at least for the past 3 or 4 years. The origination of the term dominionism, again, as far as I can tell in my own research, emanated from a book by Sarah Diamond in 2005, where she understood the idea from Genesis 3, where Adam and Eve are told to take dominion over the beast of the beast of the field, the birds of the air, these types of things, where they were to actively work there in the Garden of Eden by taking dominion over it. That's where the word surfaces, has been transfixed into a formal doctrinal construct that is shown forth basically under an idea of theonomy or of reconstruction. It is certainly not widely known. It is not widely adhered to among evangelicals by and large. There are not large swaths of an invisible force behind this word, but the term originated there with Sarah Diamond and has just been extrapolated through many iterations, particularly of Goldberg's book, Kingdom Coming. Kevin Phillips talks about this a bit in his book some years ago about theonomy or a theonomic state.
Mm-hmm. And this was Michelle Bachmann Michelle Goldberg just recently wrote something about this in relation to Rick Perry and Michelle Bachmann in Newsweek. So Michelle Goldberg's book was a few years back, and I think Sarah Diamond wrote about this in the mid-1980s. Is that correct?
It is, and she emerged in her book in 2005, Sarah Diamond did, and
okay.
Then Kingdom Coming there with Michelle basically was leading up to the election, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what she broke the news in a way that would basically ferret out ideas that were subversive and trying to talk about a religious takeover of the American government.
I want to just give a pull quote to, when you talk about takeover of the government, that just sounds real serious. And this is from Michelle Goldberg's recent piece in Newsweek. She writes, quote, "Michelle Bachmann and Rick Perry aren't just devout. Both have deep ties to a fringe fundamentalist movement known as dominionism, which says Christians should rule the world." Now, I added the evil laugh in there, but I mean, that's some pretty heavy accusations, some pretty heavy stuff there.
Well, it is, and in many ways, it's pure fiction. As I said in the column when I wrote, it should be a Dan Brown novel, that rather than taking something that is a strongly researched topic and believed both academically and even empirically. There's nothing to suggest that there is a formal, organized goal by a group of people who are intent on impacting public policy with Christian theology in a way that it would Christianize the government. So that's just impossible to prove and ludicrous to even assert, to understand that even if, as she talks about it being a fringe movement, there's not a lot of movement to this fringe.
Mm-hmm.
It is nevertheless present. She is correct that it is there, but it is not a pronounced force of organized thought that has any mechanism or any method to be able to take over the American governmental system.
Now, I should stop you here and ask you if you are or ever have been a member of the Christian Reconstructionist or Dominionist.
I am not, although I have studied them at length during graduate school, but I'm not aware of any secret handshake that emerges from their number. And certainly I have not been a part of their number, though I have studied them fairly well, I think.
They don't have a secret clubhouse with a couple knocks to get in, like a speakeasy?
No, not that I know of. At least I've never been invited, nor have I been able to enter that clubhouse if it indeed exists.
Hmm. I'm wondering if that's what actually a Christian Reconstructionist would say. Maybe you're just trying to throw me off the scent of the trail.
Well, could be, but you'll have to take me at my word here, I guess.
I guess I will take you at your word. Now, you know, going back to Michelle Goldberg, too, again, she wrote this piece in Newsweek a few weeks ago, and primarily talking about Michelle Bachmann and Rick Perry. I'm wondering to what extent these accusations are new against Republican candidates. And I'm thinking about earlier candidates, specifically Sarah Palin, who ran as vice president in 2008. And this was certainly after Sarah Diamond's book in 2005. So I'm wondering, you know, to what extent Sarah Palin, who comes from a Pentecostal strand of Christianity, would have been accused of the same thing. I don't remember that very much.
She wasn't, if you'll follow the news of that campaign. Of course, she was assailed in some ways for her Christian faith because she was unabashedly conservative in a way that brought forth a theological worldview into play. I mean, she talked about her Down syndrome baby. She talked about the life issue, which are endemically theological to the core and which directly impact public policy. But it was not, you're correct, it was not until a deeper exploration offered up by these candidates themselves, in Bachmann and in Perry, to offer and proffer their religious views on the public stage, that the media began to investigate many of their sayings and their statements.
Mm-hmm.
And waiting in the wings, of course, was aberrant research by Goldberg and by Lizzo, which were able to do somewhat of a glossing of research and kind of glistening off the top, skimming it off the top in a way of cobbling it together to produce somewhat of a panoply of ideas that have emerged that state that, you know, this is actually a formal movement and that this is attached to these candidates. It is largely the reason that these candidates themselves have voiced these ideas in a much more articulated and detailed way than did Palin. That is giving credence to the furtherance of this idea right now in this campaign.
Yeah, I can kind of see how the media oftentimes grabs on to certain ideas and they play off one another. You will hear them say the same term over and over again, such as gravitas or the optics of the situation. And it just seems that this is another instance of that where they hear the word dominionism. This is something new. It's fresh. Somebody over there at that news network is doing it. I'm going to grab on to this as well and just run with it. So it seems to be the case in that regard. And
well, exactly. I think that you're seeing the spectacle of the American media industry has become. I think that it is in many ways a lazy method of dealing with the news. But I think you're seeing that whenever there's something new on the horizon, when words matter in these candidates' platforms, even as they make stump speeches and refer to these, there's someone always listening very well and eager to move these ideas to the forefront to make news. The subsequent ideas of a new discovery of this Reconstructionistic movement have certainly furthered the conversation down the road in such a way that it's not necessarily factual, but it's certainly sensational in a way that it does raise questions. What is exactly going on here? Who are these people? Is this true? Is this correct? And the very fact that these questions are raised helps in the news ratings. Let's just be honest about that.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we're seeing here, a little bit of a media phenomenon.
Yeah, kind of a touch of yellow journalism that has always...
A touch? I appreciate that. What you just said, yes. I don't want to say it's endemically with a motive to do that, but yes, there is a bit of yellow journalism going on in that as there hasn't been a deep penetration into the facts of the ideas that would thereby, you know, sanction a proportion of that, yes, this is actually a movement. It just has not been well researched, as I pointed out in the column. It has been somewhat cobbled together, which if in your university, and where I studied as well, would get you poor marks. It just has not been done scientifically in a way that traces back and the ideas back to their origination to the primary sources.
Well, let's go ahead and do that and really explore this idea of dominionism or Christian Reconstructionism, because it is something that's out there. And as you mentioned, Michelle Goldberg and Ryan Liza might have superficial views of this thing. So here's my question for you. From where or whence does this notion of dominionism or Christian Reconstructionism come from? Now, you know, I can imagine that some might claim that it has American roots as deep as John Winthrop, who made his famous declaration in the 1600s that the American colonies would be a city on the hill for the rest of the world to see. So where does this stuff come from?
Well, it goes back much further than the American experiment or the American founding of the Republic, although Reagan in his great speech there before in his inaugural speech talks about the city on a hill and kind of put forward the idea that Winthrop might have been one of the first people to state such as far as a nation state becoming an instrument of God in God's hands. I think we should go back some centuries and understand from the very beginning of understanding of Scripture that the breaking in of God upon the earth in time constituted somewhat of a bifurcation of kingdoms. There is a post-fall, as we would have it in theological circles of the book of Genesis, after the fall of men and mankind, there was a rebuilding effort garnered by the impetus and the initiative of God to rebuild or to restore and ultimately bringing forth what Christians would understand as the Messiah or the Lord Jesus Christ as the Savior of the world. Now, how that happened, as we look at the Old Testament, we see that piece by piece, step by step, largely through the establishment of ethnic Israel, the nation state of Israel, the Hebrews, that God established his track record, if you please, to bring forth the Messiah. Under that nation state, under that government, which was theocratic, governed by the law of God, the Decalogue, the ceremonial laws, the civil laws, the moral laws, which we find in the Old Testament, there emanated a particular type of nation in the Hebrews. And we can read through the Old Testament and see that it was not a perfect state. Christians were understanding as sin impacting every area of this existence of this nation. However, as we moderns look back and look back to the Old Testament, we look at the laws of the civil laws governing that people, the ceremonial laws, and the moral laws. These are classical divisions in theology that we look at the Old Testament and observe, and we try to make sense of it looking here from our modern political nation state in the American Republic. And often, we draw non-integral conclusions coming from the Old Testament to the modern nation state of which we have today. And this has been a perennial problem for Christians. We go back to Augustine, the great theologian, the patristic father there, who understood that there was an overlap between theology or Christian theology and the idea of kingdom or the idea of nations. And nations are ruled by some reigning idea. There is some idea that is framing, that is bringing about structure to their life together. Of course, Augustine's famous phrase when he talked about the nation state, or he talked about the two kingdoms in his book, The City of God, which is must reading for anyone that would want to understand the city of God, the city of man, these bifurcation, these two kingdoms, when he basically called out the government and said, you call this person a pirate because he does it by force, by taking something that's not his, but because, in the words of Augustine, you have a mighty navy, you're called an emperor. So you see there Augustine's understanding that theft by legal means under a nation state or a national law does have theological ramifications. You come up to Calvin, you come up to Luther, the time of the Protestant Reformation, you come up to Zwingli, you come up to Knox, and you find discussions that emerge from the idea that as we read Scripture, as the church is active in this world, there's going to be an impact into the wider culture of nations, and the ideas emanating from that impact are what have shaped much of Western civilization. I think that is incontrovertible, but it is not exclusively Christian, as I shared in my column. It is a political tapestry that emerges from you know, some of the theonomic understanding of the Hebrew nation state. But we draw from the Roman Senate in those times, in that time of the Roman Empire. We understand from the Greek city-states. We brought all these tapestries, this and a tapestry together to have a modern nation state. So to state, therefore, back to making a full circle here, to understand that the idea of dominionism or Christian reconstruction or anything like this is something new is just not understanding the subject well. Christians, and likewise non-Christians, who interact with Christians and nations, have been struggling with this for millennia.
Yeah, that's, I think, a very important point for somebody like me who's a political scientist and an economist as well, and we oftentimes think in the secular realm, we downplay the role that the ideas that are within the culture at the time have an important shaping effect on the political realm. We often do that, and I think it as you mentioned, Augustine, you know, his work, The City of God, is a good reminder that we have to take this rather seriously. Now, in terms of this modern dominionism or Christian reconstructionism and the thinking about to what extent does our theology, does our understanding of the spiritual influence the way that we govern and organize our society, it's been traced back to this guy, Rusus John Rushdoony, or at least it's been talked about. You talk about it in your column a little bit, as well as Diamond and Goldberg mentioned this guy. Who is this Rusus John Rushdoony?
I think that if you ask five evangelicals or the five people in any church on Sunday who this man was, no one would know. He is somewhat of an obscure figure. And he is somewhat of a critical thinker that has been able to codify an understanding that statecraft, to borrow the words of George Will, is soulcraft, S-O-U-L, craft, meaning that the ideas of legislation or the laws of a nation are grounded in many ways on a vision of morality that is legislated formally in law. The very presence of law that you shall not do something and you may do this or that reveals that there is a regnant worldview that is in play, whether we want to admit that or not. It may be a secular idea where there is eviscerated in that thought any idea of a supreme being or of a God, but therefore to state unequivocally, as I think Goldberg and Liz at least hint toward, that the mere idea of law is innocuous and free from any theological or any mooring of morality is just untrue. And this is the idea that Rushdoony seized upon and brought forward. As you know, Rushdoony was a child of his age. He died in 2001. He was born in 1916. He was an immigrant. His parents were immigrants. He came to New York City. He later went on to be a minister. He pastored. His father was a pastor. He grew up in the home of a pastor. Went on to University of California at Berkeley. Took an undergraduate in English. Became a teacher.
Wait. You said he was an English major at University of California, Berkeley?
He was.
Yes,
he sure was. He got his undergraduate degree in English.
That must have been before the 1960s, right?
Right. He if memory serves me correct, he got it, I think, in the 30s that he went and obtained his undergraduate degree in English there from UC Berkeley, and then went on. And he was very, very interested in education. I remember hearing him speak when I was a college sophomore. It was a very, very small church in southwest Louisiana, actually in Cajun country. And I was invited over to hear Rushdoony speak. There was about 100 people in attendance there at that little meeting. And he stood to the pulpit there, and he was a riveting speaker. I remember to this day what he said. He said, his first words out of his mouth as he stood forward to speak were the way that you understand a culture of any nation is by observing the law and education of the land. And American law and education are humanistic to the core. And then he went on to talk about tracing the roots philosophically and theologically to the idea that the American nation was founded on biblical principles, and thereby, not just those biblical principles, but a return to the Old Testament civil and moral law would thereby restore and preserve the American nation as what you refer to as Wyndham seized on this city on a hill, or a nation that is in covenant with God. As you know, in the study of American religion, you can look through people like the greatest theologian that America has ever produced. Jonathan Edwards had this idea of a national covenant, that a nation could enter into covenant with God in similar ways as the Hebrews did, and thereby have a special place in God's providence and plan. Of course, this idea is disproved by Calvin himself. As I allude to this in my column and bring forward a source from Calvin, his Institutes of the Christian Religion, is that Calvin said, no, there's no need for nation states to bring forward the Mosaic law as the foundation and the reigning idea of law for that nation. There's no requirement in Holy Scripture for that to be the case. Yeah, Rush Duty would disagree with that.
Yeah, I want to stop you there, because I think when people in the when people in the media do pick up this notion, or if they touch upon Rush Duty and he's saying we need to, you know, reground our nation back on biblical principles and harkens back to the Old Testament, I mean, that immediately gets people thinking, oh, you're going to stone people to death, or you're going to take away my bacon. And, you know, for me, taking away bacon would be a pretty horrendous thing. I don't know if I could live in the United States without bacon.
Totally agree. Yes.
So we're, I mean, how is this balanced within Rush Dooney's thinking? Is he going to that extreme, or what does he really mean?
Well, yes, he is going to that extreme.
Okay.
I think if you read his magisterial work that many would point to, that as far as was one of the dominant works of his life, Institutes of Biblical Law, which were appropriately named in a way that would try to juxtapose him both in congruency and in some ways against Calvin in the Institutes of Christian Religion, which, as you know, from those Calvin's institutes were a mighty force in the formation and the development of the Reformation, the Protestant Reformation, and emanating down some of the greatest literature and theological understanding known in our modern era. But yes, there is this criticism, and Rush Dooney would certainly admit to it. In this, it's almost a 2,000-page opus of his, the Institutes of Biblical Law, where he tried to basically legislate from the Old Testament applications for modern sin, if you please, homosexuality, adultery, incest. It went down to such detailed areas of lying about one's virginity, bestiality, witchcraft. You can move forward to idolatry, kidnapping, rape. These types of things all became capital cases in the idea in Rush Dooney's world. Now, that is just if you look at this and you understand hermeneutics, from a mere general orientation of hermeneutics, this can easily be dismissed as an inaccurate hermeneutic that is not dealing well with civil, moral, and ceremonial laws of the Old Testament. And that is the issue. How do we, as modern Americans or modern citizens of a modern nation state, handle the Old Testament as it regards to and has direct application to modern statecraft? And that is the issue.
Mm-hmm. How big of a following did this Rush Dooney guy have in his time?
Well, very small. I don't think many people would even know his name.
Yeah.
Most would have never heard of him if you were to ask them on the street, or even ask a devout evangelical. That's kind of the in-church every Sunday type of a person with his family. Who is this man? They would have never heard of him. But the power of the pen, his books, now with the Chalcedon Foundation, taking the name from Chalcedonian Christology, you know, where you're understanding the Council of Chalcedon, the Creed of Chalcedon, showing forth the identity of Jesus in the modern day, as what Rush Dooney would talk about. His son, his family has kept this alive through a website, the Chalcedon Foundation, all these things. It's a small following, but they are extremely volatile in some ways because of the publishing and web presence that they have today. So the ideas are not mainstream, but their ideas are pronounced and present in that they still have a following, albeit small.
Now, Rush Dooney's name has come up occasionally linked to the homeschooling movement, and you had mentioned that he's very much interested in education. So is there any big connection between Rush Dooney and the modern homeschooling movement that's been rising over the last two, 3 decades or so?
Right. The idea of homeschooling, or the homeschooling movement, if you were to look at some of the research of Jay Green at the University of Arkansas or others, and you would see how the rise of homeschooling has come about and trace it back to its kind of initial formulaic idea, the embryonic movement, if you please. Certainly, Christians or evangelicals would have a stake in that trajectory. It cannot be attributed directly to him, although he was a strong advocate of teaching of the classical rubric, but you cannot pin on him the formation nor the organization of the homeschooling movement. But that's just untrue. Many times, there are widespread others. Dorothy Sayers, who wrote The Recovering the Lost Tools of Learning, where she reintroduces into the mainstream of educational theory the idea of the trivium, and we even now have the quadrivium and classical learning. All these ideas cannot be attributed back to Rush Dooney. Although, again, I must say, as I said previously, his ideas are there, they are pronounced, and they do have a following. But to say that he is the father of the modern homeschooling movement is, I do not believe that is correct.
Yeah, and thinking back to what we were talking earlier about the media, you know, it sounds like this Rush Dooney character is something that the media would really love to grab onto, because he is very vocal in things. He has very different views than many other people. And so it'd probably be very easy for media folks and other authors to really focus on him. But in your column, you talk about another one of the persons who has thought about this issue of relating Christian morality to the public sphere or the public arena, and that's Francis Schaeffer. And who is this Francis Schaeffer guy?
Now, here's a name you would find quite influential in areas of evangelical life. If you were to read any of the writings of prominent evangelicals such as Chuck Colson, the late D. James Kennedy, you would find a mention of a wide and deep influence in their lives from Francis Schaeffer. Francis Schaeffer, died earlier about 10 years ago, was a Presbyterian minister. He was a minister of the gospel who read widely, was a philosopher, trained in professional philosophy, theology, began a place in Switzerland called the Brie, where people, during the 60s, during the 70s, when all things were being questioned, where there seems to be an evisceration of meaning, when the Vietnam War was having its sway, when public policy was out of control, when many things just seemed to be coming apart at the seams. Schaeffer offered a safe place for young people, and old people for that matter, to come away to study some of the great books of both of the Christian tradition and of the Western tradition, as well as experience community in a way that was not communistic, but was caring, that would have much of what the local church should be for many people as they seek out that type of community. He wrote a book, How Now Shall We Live? How Then Should We Live? It's an excellent book. It's still in print, as I understand it. The Light Revell Publishers may have had the last printing of that. You know, How Should We Then Live is a massive influence in Christian life today. He later wrote a book called A Christian Manifesto that somewhat emerged after Roe v. Wade was passed. He thought that the decision of legalized abortion was terrible. was an abomination, to borrow some of his words, to the nation, to our nation of the United States, and sought to find a way to mobilize the church, the local churches, in a way that would propel them forward for a maximum or at least a pronounced influence in their culture.
And how, in terms of this, I mean, this is occurring in the 1970s. It seems that this is the connection or the reconnection of evangelicals into the public arena. He had a great deal of influence over that?
He did. He called for, he was the one that, he called for this. He called for action. He called for a way of understanding the state, theologically. If you look at his writings, and he basically outlines a way and ways to impact both the government and the culture in a way that could possibly, in his words, save it or preserve the culture from paganism or a runaway the runaway train of a culture out of control. And so he's been popularized in some ways because he broke out of the academy. You know, these discussions, largely prior to Schaeffer, were reserved for those professional students of religion or of theology or for seminarians or for people who were active and possibly studying in the ministry or even those who had a secular worldview who desired only the mere academic orientation of religion. Schaeffer brought this out, popularized these ideas. They broke into the mainstream of thought in modern evangelical life and beyond. And through his books and through the ideas of what he has articulated there and the presence of people like Chuck Colson, like D. James Kennedy, the media, all these things, television, radio, many of evangelical leaders, many some on what would be classified as modern fundamentalism, Jerry Falwell, all these claim Schaeffer as their father in the understanding of these ideas.
And I guess that gets us to the question of one's role or the role of one's religious faith and what role that should play in the public arena. And, you know, not specifically just for citizens, but also for public officials. And the big question that evangelicals have had to wrangle with over the past several decades is, you know, does one leave one's religious faith at the town hall door? And I think this is going to lead us back to our discussion a little bit of Michelle Bachmann and Rick Perry and others such as George Bush. But I want you to kind of talk about that because that was one of your things that you thought about when you were at Johns Hopkins writing your thesis. So what are your thoughts in terms of this? How does one take one's spiritual faith in a secular nation and then inject it into the way that you view policy and that you make policy?
I think we should step back to a seminal moment in American history when James Madison, who himself was tutored by none other than the Presbyterian minister John Witherspoon, framed in his home state of Virginia, James Madison, the remonstrance there calling for a separation in a way that, not a formal separation, but putting the government off limits to religion. To James Madison, the father of the Constitution of the United States in many ways, the idea of a state-sponsored religion was the very way to destroy both the church and the state. And so in the state of Virginia, when he put this forward, it was an idea that both areas were so important, and both areas did have overlap in ideas and philosophy. But to wed them together, to fuse them together in a way that made them one in the same, was dangerous, and Madison believed that it would ultimately be the demise of both the church and the state. For the church, it could become mere formalism, that the rituals of the church had no deep and spiritual meaning. For the state, it could mean easily corruption, almost a religiously compelled idea of cronyism. We hear of crony capitalism today. I mean, James Madison had this beat by hundreds of years. He wanted no religious cronyism and would not hear of that. But those ideas that he put forward reveal that there is always a close relationship between religion and public policy or public issues. It's just going to be there. You read the writings of Locke, the father of, and many would say that the Enlightenment, and both of our American experiment, many would posit. Many of his writings read like theology. This man spoke of justification, the idea that was championed in the modern Protestant Reformation back in that year in the 1500s. This man read theology. He called for his act of toleration, that the church would have its sphere. You hear things like Abraham Kuyper talking about sphere sovereignty, where these various spheres come about. So the idea is perennial, but the idea that's emerging in the American experiment was so pronounced because of the great influence of the church in early New England. And I learned all of this by reading Harry Stout's work, especially his book, The New England Soul. I mean, if you read that book and you understand what he's talking about there, one of the things that he talks about was the weekly sermon was attended by pretty much everyone in the town, whether you were a professing Christian or not. And the sermon, to quote him, quote, was authority incarnate. And it was a very, very powerful influence that these early pastors had. Coming out of the Great Awakenings of the United States, George Whitefield and everything, where these were popularized in a way, preaching was a very, very powerful profession. And in four of these were very educated men that were in the pulpits. They had studied philosophy and law and political theory and all these things in addition to the Bible itself. So what we see is that there is a perennial question that emerges between church and state. And it has not been fully worked out because the church would say we have an authority here established by God himself over the kingdoms of this world that in some ways the kingdoms of this world should adhere to and understand. Of course, they follow a savior, a leader, a king who said, my kingdom is not of this world. And so we have the state on this side saying, wait just a minute, religion is a poison. Religion is a corrupting factor in political life. Religion can be corrupting to public policy. It can set forth a worldview that is not helpful to advance the ideas that the state wants to do. But the Christians would say, well, wait just a minute, where are you getting these ideas of caring for the poor? Where are you getting these ideas of poverty alleviation? Where are you getting these ideas of mitigating some of the ills of society? Why do we have areas of ideas that you shall not kill, you shall not steal? Do these not emanate from the Christian Decalogue as found in the Old Testament? And so we see the problem. So we have to understand this in a way that this problem is nothing new. There has been no new discovery by Lizza or by Goldberg. A mere reading of American history would take care of that. The war between the states, the Civil War, was endemically theological. I mean, you see this again in Stout's work, where he talks about both sides. And, of course, Lincoln talked about this, pray to the same God in some way. How has this worked out? How do we understand all this? And the very idea is this. We haven't worked it out. We are a religious nation. That is, again, incontrovertible. But the ideas that are emanating today from Goldberg and from Lizza are not new discoveries. And the statements of Bachman and Perry are nothing that would cause great alarm. There were far more religious speeches given by earlier politicians than what they're doing today. If you were to read some of Washington's speeches, the first president of the United States, he was very, very religious in many of his ideas, far more than Bachman or Perry is today. So I think the idea, the question, the conundrum of which you have discovered in thinking about this idea has been present with us since the American founding and beyond that in the ideas of nation states. That's not going to be immediately solved, but we have to work this out where there's a toleration, yes, for the marketplace of ideas and religions to be formulated and have an influence in ways that does not become tyrannical. And that is the genius of the American founders, to be able to put in place a mechanism, a system, whereby religion can be practiced and influenced apart from and without the sanction of government.
You put this very nicely, and this is something that I think about quite frequently in my work, the tension between church and state and to what extent each can corrupt one another. Now, when we're talking about the works of the people who are clanging the alarm bells of dominionism, they're mostly concerned about the undue influence of religion in the public sphere, especially in a increasingly diverse America where some people may choose not to have a faith. So they get rather worried about that. On the other hand, too, as you mentioned, and I think a lot of people forget about this, but government can have a corrupting influence on religious institutions and on religious individuals as well when they move into the public sphere. And one of the things I've recently thought about, and as you were talking about this tension, I was thinking about George W. Bush's faith-based initiative. And Bush, as a compassionate conservative trying to bring his own religious philosophy into the workings of government, we see this tension playing out here. And he, you know, implemented, in part, he was building upon what Bill Clinton had been doing in the 1990s with his charitable choice initiative, but trying to bring faith-based communities in greater connection with government. And I just wonder what your thought is on that in relation to what you're talking about, this tension between how much do we bring our faith into the public sphere.
Prior to the New Deal and between the New Deal and the Great Society, as I'm using these as two polarities or two memorable pillars, if you will, in the modern expression of the welfare state. And I realize I'm putting forth an idea out there that is not, we've not laid the groundwork for, but the idea of public welfare, of social morality, if you please. Prior to these governmental establishments of programs to help the poor, unwed mothers, women, infants, and children, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the social safety net as we know in modern parlance with governmental activism, the philanthropy and charity and orphanages and ways of dealing with societal ills were largely managed and handled by churches, private organizations, philanthropists, basically just people of faith that saw the ills of society and saw the ills of the world and sought to reach out to them. The modern administrative state, as we see founded today in the government of our own nation and the various departments of labor and interior and education, of course, Department of Justice, ideas, these departments of state have at their disposal millions of dollars of funds that go out for charitable purposes, or for ideas of philanthropy, or for helping those in need. And there are entire sub-industries and sub-cottage industries of granting agencies which are able to navigate the quite complicated path of granting through these agencies to receive millions of dollars for services or ideas or programs for the poor, unwed mothers, ideas like this. These are all things that are available through governmental funds. The idea, as I understand it, from what President Clinton began to do when he was in office and was really seized and advanced. Of course, I realize some would say it was not advanced, it was corrupted. I understand that, but the idea was advanced under President Bush was, there's an unlevel playing field here. There are many, many charities and outposts of charity located in rural areas of America that are operating on shoestring budgets, that barely can meet budgets, but that are seeing hundreds of people, that are doing fine work, that have really no management capacity whatsoever. They're existing basically from day to day. And he wanted to make available to them the same opportunities that were available to someone like a Planned Parenthood or someone like that that had much of their funds emanating from government coffers.
Secular nonprofit groups.
Exactly, right. And this created no small spectrum of controversy. It went all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States, as you know. And what they were trying to do was level that playing field there, because it was such a the competition, the behemoth of those upon those small entities could not be met without intentional, organized help. And the idea that emerged from that, championed in many ways by Marvin Olasky, the editor of World Magazine, who studied greatly areas of philanthropy and ideas from these earlier eras of charity, was that should that be advanced, there would be a capacity to be built for non-governmental charity, non-governmental areas that had a faith-based component, could grow and move toward a means of alleviating or mitigating poverty in a way, in many ways, that was better than the large governmental bureaucracies of the United States government. They were far more nimble, they were flexible, they were responsive to their constituencies and communities, and they just did a better job than the formal bureaucracies of the United States government. So that's the idea behind the faith-based and community. You remember that? That was a big part of it, the community initiative. President Obama has brought in Joshua Dubois to try to do this as well. There's still funding available, but it's a minuscule amount compared to the entitlement programs, to all that is present to be able to do. In many ways, here's where the rub comes. What the church or the home or other places, other institutions other than government should be doing or have been doing to alleviate the pain of societal ills.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that is interesting, when this came up, I know a number of people went into high hyperbole that this was Bush imposing a theocracy. Now, I don't remember the term dominionism or Christian reconstructionism being used when he was proposing these ideas of the faith-based initiative. But one of the interesting things, and this goes back to the tension we were talking about a while ago regarding evangelicals, was that a number of evangelicals were very suspicious of this. They didn't jump wholeheartedly into this faith-based initiative because, again, going back to James Madison, they saw not only could religion be a corrupting influence on government, but also government could be a corrupting influence on religion. And a number of evangelical groups that you would think this faith-based initiative was targeted for really treaded quite lightly in reacting to this program. They weren't all that enthusiastic about it, if I was correct.
Well, indeed, Dr. Richard Land, the president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of my own denomination, the Southern Baptist Convention, was very skeptical of this idea. Of course, in the Baptist tradition, we are skeptical of government in many ways, fearing, just as I said earlier, corruption of the theological dynamic that is exclusively in the church the government could never replicate even if it tried. So he was one, a vocal critic of this effort. And indeed, it is a tension, and it is a pronounced tension. And I think one of the benefits of Goldberg's writing and Elizabeth's writing is that it has brought out into the open once again these ideas. But I think we're now at this stage of our understanding and development as a nation, of understanding the ideas of religion and public policy, the church and the state, we are better able to deal with them as we are better equipped to discuss them in a way that, in a dispassionate way, I trust, that would not give way to hyperbole and to exaggeration. Now, I think the very presence of Goldberg and of Liz's ideas have given way to hyperbole and exaggeration, but they have at least introduced to a mainstream audience. They have broken out of the bubble, if you please, of evangelical life or of religious life into the national stage. And it has created for us an opportunity to discuss these issues and to honestly face some of these issues in a way that could help us, I trust, to move forward together through these ideas as a nation. I think at our best, that is what the purpose of a political campaign would be, is that we rigorously examine the ideas of those candidates, and when we see problems or clashes or obvious polarities or conflict, that we are able to discuss these together in a way that would bring us toward more of not just of a consensus, but of an advancement to say, hey, here's where we need to improve and how we can do so. If we do not do that, I fear that we could easily collapse or revert, shall I say, mm-hmm. back into religious wars, which have no meaning and seemingly take us on a never-ending spiral of attack.
Now, it certainly is a healthy discussion to be having, and the fact that Michelle Bachmann and Rick Perry are very devout individuals and wear that devotion on their sleeves to some extent, or at least to some extent greater than other candidates we have in the past, has really given rise to this discussion. So I think in the closing moments here, I'd just like you to reflect upon those two candidates, Michelle Bachmann and Rick Perry. And you're a close observer of this. You live a little bit closer to Texas than Minnesota, so you might have a little bit better idea about Rick Perry. But how do you see religion playing out in the ideas and governance of these two individuals? And to what extent do you think it might shape their role as president should either of them be elected next year?
Well, I have not spoken to them or to their campaigns. I've only been able to ascertain my understanding of what they're purporting from their public statements and private writings and from their record together. We'll take Bachmann at first. Of course, she is greatly influenced by Schaefer, as she by her own testimony. She's obviously a reader of theology. She's obviously a very serious Christian. By serious, I mean she attends church. She obviously reads scripture. She's obviously cognizant of the ideas of some basic orientations of theology. She's certainly studied in some of the bastions of evangelical thought today, Regent University, and these ideas like that. She's a trained lawyer. For all the efforts to the contrary, she's certainly no dummy in a way that would cause her to be an absolutely ineffective candidate. I think if even as a congresswoman, she has proven herself to have a capacity to deal with some very tenacious ideas and have come out emerging the victor in some of those ways. I think it's how this would reflect in her governance style. I think that as a conservative, and we go back to the hearkening back to the ideas of Russell Kirk himself, that the very philosophy of conservatism has a deeply embedded theological component that would state that the government is not God, that there is a power, a being, whatever you want to call it, that is above and beyond the mere existence of this terrestrial ball, that there is an idea that there is something greater than the mere mechanics of government or the mere creations of men. And so that fuels both of them. You hear Rick Perry talking about, I want to make Washington as inconsequential in your life as possible. This is emerging from a worldview and from an idea, dare I say a theological worldview, that the state dare not, and Perry would definitely believe this, intrude or even formulate an idea of statism, that the state will handle all the problems for individuals across the board. What many conservatives would call from womb to tomb care, you know. My former boss, Governor Mike Huckabee, talked about this extensively when he was in office, about womb to tomb care. So it's how I see the effect of their candidacies. We're going to hear more about this. Just yesterday, Rick Perry was at Liberty University. The expression of the late Jerry Falwell, his son Jonathan Falwell, now the chancellor of that institution, and the pastor of Thomas Road Baptist Church there in Lynchburg. Perry spoke before their entire student body and faculty, openly spoke of his testimony of conversion to Christ. You're going to hear more of that. You're going to hear more of that from Bachmann. You're going to hear a bit more of that probably in the debates in some ways, though I think the economy and jobs and the competency factor will trump some of that. But you're going to see more and more of an exploration and a vetting of these candidates and their worldview of government. And their worldview of government is endemically theological. It doesn't mean it's theonomic. It doesn't mean that they want to reinstitute the Mosaic Code for the modern American Republic. But it does mean that they are students of Scripture. It does mean that they're students of the Church. And they are serious about their faith. Now, will that revert? And I use that word purposely. Will that revert, hearkening back to what people like Dan Savage would call reactionary Puritanism? I would think not. But I do think we're going to see religion, and particularly evangelicalism, brought into the light of scrutiny during this campaign. And I think we have not seen the last of it. I would think, and I would hope, that articles such as Goldberg and Lizzo would be on the wane, and other research and ideas from journalism would be coming to the fore. But that is yet to be seen.
Well, I think you're doing your part in doing that with your column on Pathos.com. And again, we'll link to that for our listeners. It's a wonderful column that comes out. I think you write once every 2 weeks or so.
I do. Uh-huh.
And it's a great way to keep up with contemporary affairs. And it brings in a lot of these issues, even though you might not speak directly to the issue of dominionism or church state issues. I think that is always circulating in the back of a number of your writings. And so we will link to that. And again, this issue that you bring up about Goldberg and Lizzo with their, I guess, big hyperbole too, one really has to wonder to what extent a Rick Perry or a Michelle Bachmann could actually create a new theocracy in the large government that we even have today. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I'm always reminded of President Reagan's frustration when he said, "I give an order and it's frustrated two levels down in the civil service."
Mm-hmm.
The government of the United States is so very large, so very vast. It's in its bureaucracy and its reach, its state presence in the states. If you were to look at, for instance, with the American Jobs Act that we see that is being was put out this week by President Obama, it is a massive experiment, an expose, if you please, of the way our modern government works. I mean, states apply for funds with the consent of the governor. There's a process in place whereby, monitoring and metrics are gleaned at every level from state and from the feds, the state, to the local levels. We have sub-grants emanating from these grants, and it's just a massive, massive, complex structure. I do not think that it would be possible for any president of the United States, and even with the modern idea of the modern imperial presidency, to Boris Schlesinger's idea, that it would be possible to change the administrative state and the way that we're doing things around on a dime. Now, that's just not going to happen, and there's no way that a vision of stoning, as we try to bring these ludicrous ideas, they're absurd when you start thinking about how they would be implemented, of stoning homosexuals or things like that. That would never fly under the jurisprudence of the United States of America. Our laws would never sanction that. Our law is not built on the Old Testament. It's built on the code as understood by, as Oliver Wendell Holmes talks about, of the great Supreme Court justice that he was. When you talk about his idea of law emanating from the culture, that's true. And so at some point, cooler heads will prevail, and these ideas will never surface. What I hope personally will emerge is a new robust discussion that will again bring us to some very critical questions, some of which we've raised in this time together, about the role of government, the capacity of government, how do we deal with this, how do we deal with the welfare state, how do we deal with the administrative state, and what the future of the nation will be, apart from ways that we can, attack one another over ideas of social welfare. That's ultimately what this comes down to. How will the government, or should the government, continue in its massive investment, as it were, to alleviate what many would consider theological issues, Christian issues, or at least, even in secular thought, would be religious issues, of caring for the poor, feeding the hungry, infants, health care. The entire idea of health care is endemically religious to the core. It's a moral issue that will ultimately find its resting place somewhere, and the rigorous debate which we have today is where will that place be? How will that be shaped? What will be the driving force behind that? And to eliminate religion, any type of religious idea, from that conversation is just disingenuous in a way, because in many ways the heart and the motivation of the ethical dimensions of public policy, especially when they come in, as Larry Mead would talk about, Lawrence Mead of Brookings Institute would talk about, these emanate from an idea of compassion, and which are endemically religious ideas calling for the help of your fellow man, especially when they're in need. So we're going to see this in the campaign. We're hopeful. I am hopeful that the discussion will rise to a new level. I think that it's going to be prevalent, and I think we're going to have quite an interesting season before us.
Well, I think that's a really nice way to close on this, although I have to admit I think you've skirted around one of the great theological questions that is plaguing our era, that is addressed to our nation nowadays, and being that you are a native of Louisiana, the really big question in that state where football is considered a religion is, will Louisiana State University win the national championship this year?
Well, you often know, since Dr. Gill, since you were a political scientist, that we vote early and often in the state of Louisiana. And Huey P. Long, whose remains rest on the grounds of our state capitol under a statue there, we believe still, in many ways, the ghost of Long still operates at Louisiana State University. And the memory that I have is this huge picture as a young undergraduate student of him leading the LSU Tiger Band down Main Street in Baton Rouge as the drum major of the band. So you're exactly correct that to say that football in Louisiana is a religion is probably lamentably true. I must go with my former classmate, Shaquille O'Neal, who was at the ball game this past week. I don't know if you saw that.
Mm-hmm.
He was there walking around. He's a celebrity. A huge statue has been erected of him right by Maravich. We call it Pete's Palace there. And I'll just go with Shaquille and close with his words, trusting his wisdom better than my own. We are on our way to a national championship. So I'm sure if that does not come true, you'll be phoning me back for a concession. But at this point, I think we're going to do just fine.
All right. Well, on that, we'll end. I want to thank you for talking about these issues of church-state relations, of the proper role of religion in public policy, and the issue of dominionism as well. You've done a great deal of service to the public in your own column, as I mentioned before, discussing these issues. And I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
It is my honor, sir. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.